Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later in the hour, I'll talk with poet Kelsey Bigelow about her new collection, Far From Broken. But first, given our love of fairy tales, pretty much everyone in the English-speaking world has read works of literature in translation. But many of us don't know that when a novel, a story, or a poem is translated for publication, the process is much more complicated than simply translating. It's truly an art. The University of Iowa is home to the country's oldest literary translation workshop. It turned 60 last year, and their translation MFA program is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. Aron Aji is here. He's director of translation programs and an associate professor of instruction at the University of Iowa. Aron, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I know that the translation workshop was founded before you got here.
Yes.
But tell me a little bit about the history. How did it come about?
Yes. As you know, the University of Iowa has hosted international writers for over 55 years. And the first translation workshop was imagined and created by Paul Engel, who thought that the...
And he was the director of the writers' workshop
at the time. And he thought that it would be great for the international writers to work with the creative writing students and to develop some manuscripts so that they can be introduced to the English-speaking world. So they cooked up this idea that was quite unusual because this was a collaborative translation workshop. But it really caught, and that's 60 years ago. And then in 1973-74, Danny Weisbord and Gayatri Spivak, who were both here, began the MFA program in literary translation as part of the comparative literature program, which was also very revolutionary because it was the first MFA in literary translation inside the comparative literature program. And so that's really how it all started.
All right. And we'll talk more about the process and what goes into literary translation in a few minutes. But I want to ask about you. How you're originally from Turkey.
Correct.
How did you get involved in literary translation?
Well, there's a very personal reason for it. The longer I stayed in this country, the more I realized that I was losing contact with my own language. And I've always wanted to try to translate. I had brought, in fact, 42 years ago, I had brought a handful of books with me that I wanted to translate, which I never did. But so with that, you know, intent to really sort of regain my link to my native language, I started translating. And it was a sheer coincidence that I was very taken by an incredible Turkish author who had just passed away during a summer I was there. And I contacted their publisher, who turned out to be my classmate from our university years. Oddly, I started as a chemical engineer and she started as a mechanical engineer, but we both found ourselves in literature. So that's how I started, and I've been translating for about 30 years now.
It is unusual for someone to translate for publication in their second language.
Correct.
You are a native speaker of Turkish. Mm-hmm. So was that a barrier for you?
Well, it wasn't a barrier for me, but it was a puzzlement for many people around me that I would do such a thing. My explanation is that in order to really translate the literary text, what is most important is what your literary language is. I studied literature and comparative literature in English. So my literary language has always been English. I read Turkish literature, of course, but I didn't study it in Turkish. So I came to this with maybe with some foolish courage, but in my mind it was quite justified because, as I say to my students now, it's not really, a native speaker is not an automatic translator into their language any more than a person who learns a language in a formal setting becomes a great translator from that language. So what matters is where we created this relationship, this deep, intense, intimate relationship with literature. And in my case, it was English.
You got involved in literary translation. What brought you to academia? What brought you into the university to become the director of this department?
I was in the academy. I had appointments in two other institutions before I came here. And I came here myself. I in fact, came to the University of Iowa at the time, talked with Russell Ganim, who is now the Vice President of International, Associate Vice President of International Programs. And I said, you know, I think we need to grow this program. And I said, I will be happy to give it a try. I have been very invested in the profession and the training of translators for many years before. I was past president of the American Literary Translators Association. So they took a chance with us, I suppose, with me. And I've been here for 10 years now.
The history of this program is long, as we mentioned. The translation workshop turned 60. The MFA program is turning 50. But when you came into the program, there were some questions about its future?
Yes, there were.
Tell me a little bit about what was going on.
Well, you know, the college reorganized several of the program areas. One was cinema and complet, inside which was this literary translation MFA, and it was a very silent, quiet program that had fantastic alumni, but it's sort of almost survived because it was a quiet place. When Cinema and Complete was separated into two, Complete was going to be moved to the Division of World Languages, Literatures, and Cultures. And I always joke that they discovered that there was also a translation program there. So, at one point they even thought that maybe it should be discontinued. There was a recommendation to that effect. For me, it was out of question because anywhere I have been at any conference or any workshop or translation gathering, every time someone would come and say, it all started at Iowa, it all started at Iowa. So it felt like this program had to be saved and had to sort of regain its legacy, if you will, revive its significance. Because this program also came into existence at a time when translation as a field was introduced. It's a young field, translation studies. So we were at the very start, very, very crucial to the development of this incredible art and craft that we call literary translation. So I had a plan in my mind that I wanted to give it a try. And the university was, willing and kind to let me try it. But for me, there was no question that it couldn't, it had to be revived. And I think we are now going full force.
Well, give me a little idea of the scope of the department. I mean, I mentioned the workshop and the MFA program, but there's more to it than that.
Sure. Well, first of all, we are not a department. We're a program inside the Division of World Languages, Literatures, and Cultures. And what we have done since I arrived is first we really grew the program. Right now it's the largest program in the country, and we would like to think that it's the best program in the country. We have had some incredibly stellar alums who have received some very, very prestigious awards. And early on, I thought that for this program to be viable, we also had to have an undergraduate program to support us. And Denis Filios, a professor of Spanish, and I worked together to have an undergraduate minor. And at the time, we called the minor as translation for global literacy, because what is not adequately appreciated is right now in global society, virtually every exchange from goods to information takes place through translation, from our cell phone to great books of literature. So we wanted the students to sort of gain an appreciation of translation as a global literacy skill. So we had that minor. And then second step, we started a graduate certificate in literary translation and invited everyone from every MFA and graduate programs in the humanities to join us. We wanted to create a translation workshop as a creative commons for everyone, if you will. And that also took very, very well. We have been graduating, in fact, about four or five MFA students from the writers' workshop, theater, nonfiction, who also have completed the graduate certificate. And finally, as the energy built, and we really were like mounting courses that brought together almost 75 to 80 students studying translation each year. So we started the BA in translation.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We are talking about the history of the Literary Translation Workshop and MFA program at the University of Iowa and the art of literary translation. With me is Aron Aji. He is Director of Translation Programs and an Associate Professor of Instruction at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com. Support for IPR comes from The Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about The Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in just about 15 minutes, we will talk with Des Moines poet Kelsey Bigelow. She has just released her new collection, Far From Broken, today. But right now, we're talking about literary translation. The University of Iowa is home to the country's oldest literary translation workshop. The workshop turned 60 last year. The translation MFA program is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. And we were just talking about the number of students getting involved in the program. There's now a major available for University of Iowa students. And with me is Aron Aji. He is Director of Translation Programs and an Associate Professor of Instruction at the University of Iowa. We also want to bring Kelsey Veneta into the conversation. She's a graduate of the MFA program here at the University of Iowa, and she's now Program Director of American Literary Translators Association based in Arizona. Hello, Kelsey.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, and hi, Aron. It's great to hear your
voice.
Hey,
Kelsey.
Remember the history of this wonderful program. Mm-hmm.
Well, Kelsey, I'd love to know how you got involved in the program. And you are a native English speaker. So tell me first what language you work in primarily.
I work mostly from Spanish into English, primarily poetry. And I've also worked with one Swedish poet, thanks to the international writing program that Aron talked about a little bit. There was one year where I was able to be partnered with a Swedish poet. I speak a little bit of Danish through my family background, and so we collaborated on some of her poems as well.
How did you get involved in this program?
So I came to Iowa City to study an MFA in poetry. And right across the street is the International Writing Program. And I had heard about these translation workshops that I mentioned where you could be partnered with a visiting writer. So my very first semester in the poetry MFA, I took a translation workshop. And I think it was kind of a light bulb moment for me. I had never really connected my love of writing, poetry, literature, and my love of Spanish and Spanish language literature. It had never occurred to me that I could be a literary translator. And so that was a wonderful first experience. And then I went on to take more classes in the translation program as I was finishing up my poetry MFA, and was lucky enough to get to stick around and do the translation MFA with Aron as well.
Can you explain for me what it was about literary translation that really ignited your passion and your creativity?
Sure. Yeah. I think for me, creative writing and literary translation go hand in hand. So when you're translating a poem, you are always writing a new poem, but you're doing it with someone else. You have the original poet's voice and words, and I work with mostly living poets. So in many cases, you know, I have a relationship with them. You don't have to start from a blank page, but it's that wonderful feeling of creating something, creating a poem, just with different constraints is how we often say it. So that's sort of where it took off for me, I would say, is where I started to feel like, oh, I really enjoy the sort of problem solving that you do when you're translating a piece of literature, because of course it's not just content, it's also all the things that make a work literary, the sound and the poetic devices, and figuring out how to bring that across into English is just really exciting.
Well, and I think so much of what you do is invisible to readers. And we also live in this day and age of artificial intelligence. We have our Google Translate on our phones. So, mm-hmm. You know, we are in this time where we have a different kind of access to things written in another language, even if we're not fluent or studying that language ourselves. But Aron, yeah. I want to hear from both of you, but Aron, help me understand what makes literary translation different from a really verbatim kind of translation.
Oh, sure. You know, when we read a poem, we experience it, and it's a very comprehensive experience. It involves our body. It involves our emotions. You know, we feel it in the back of our neck. What really makes a literary work an experience is the tone of the work, the effect it intends to create in us, the emotional reactions we give. But also, all of these are created through literary devices like metaphors and imagery and idiom and a certain kind of register and diction. So we actually, I always say, we actually inhabit that text from inside, trying to imagine how it must have been created by the author or the poet in order to recreate it. So far, AI is not able to go this far. Maybe one day it will, but when we produce an AI-generated translation, it really feels extremely wooden, and missing in all of these elements that make the reading of a literary text an experience, an aesthetic and what I'd like to call acoustic experience.
Well, I think anybody who's ever read one of those AI translations out loud knows exactly what you're absolutely talking about. It doesn't sound like spoken or written language. Kelsey, is there anything you want to add to that? And you've both talked about poetry, but we're not just talking about poetry, right?
No.
Right. There's also literary fiction, creative nonfiction, theater, which is an area that ALTA, the American Literary Translators Association, is trying to support more and more, the translation of theater from different languages into English. The question of AI is on everybody's minds, I think, as translators. I have often heard sort of this sense of doom and gloom that the world is changing, and there's fear, I think, for some translators that this may take jobs or may come in and change the way we do things. But I was recently at the London Book Fair, and there was a wonderful panel on AI and literary translation and the way in which we may be able to use this as a tool. So things like being able to look up and do research through AI to help find solutions to those creative problem-solving moments in a translation. So I think that it's an exciting and interesting moment, and I would be excited for translators to keep thinking about how we might work with these tools rather than allowing them to, you know, do the work of literary translation, which just doesn't work, as you've described.
We're talking about the literary translation and the literary translation program at the University of Iowa. The university is home to the country's oldest literary translation workshop, which turned 60 last year, and the translation MFA program is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. I'm curious, and Aron, as someone who didn't grow up in the United States or in the English-speaking world, I would love to hear your thoughts about this, because there's so much literature produced in English, and we do tend to be very Anglocentric mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. in the United States and in the UK and other places in the world, really. I have a family member who loves literature and is Russian, and she's complained about the fact, she says, I don't think people in the United States really read literature from other places in the world. And of course, there are exceptions to that. There are the classics like Dostoevsky that, you know, mm-hmm. everybody has read. But mm-hmm. from your perspective, is there a lack of interest in literary translation, interest in reading the literature of other cultures in the United States?
Well, numbers suggest that there is such a lack. But let me also suggest that the numbers have been changing dramatically, not necessarily growing, but in terms of diversity of in the numbers, there's also growth. But right now, we have more world literature translated from a larger number of languages than before. You know, there are about 5 to 6 major languages that have sort of dominated the translation scene. Whereas now, in fact, we are able to, in fact, find a work from a language that we would not have. I mean, my whole career has been to promote Turkish literature because it's one of those less translated languages. And in fact, you brought up the issue of translating into your second language. There is a growing number of second language translators because, unfortunately, there isn't enough support in the U.S. for language education. So we, in fact, are the ones who are in a position to promote our own literatures because of that. And, you know, we in our program, we in fact always welcome international students. Last year, the graduating class of 12 had about 5 or 6 international students who were all in fact second language translators. So we're trying to make a difference in that regard. But, you know, there are about 600 titles of translation you can very easily access each year. These are new titles. And so plenty of books for anyone to read in a year.
Yes.
So I think where we have not been as good in our field is in cultivating young readership, cultivating learned readership of translation. And this is also why we have this BA now. And we also got this U.S. Department of Education grant to, and we have a Center for Translation and Global Literacy right now. And we are trying to promote the training of translation in the undergraduate curriculum. But also we've been doing things like we had a workshop with K through 12 teachers. We had a workshop with community interpreters, trying to sort of make people more alert and enthusiastic about seeking the literature that's already available.
And Kelsey, you grew up on the other side of that divide as a native English speaker in the United States.
Right.
Do you feel this growth in interest in reading the literature of other parts of the world?
I do, yeah. And I have to say it's thanks to the hard work of a lot of literary translators. We often say that literary translators are the ones who sort of need to do all of the steps that it takes in creating a work of literature, publishing it, promoting it. We have a number of real stars in our profession who've, like Jennifer Croft, who've worked on campaigns to ensure that the translator's name is on the cover of the book that they translate so that the reader knows who chose every word in that book that they're reading. And I think we've seen also, you know, increased coverage in the news. The New York Times has had a number of pieces on literary translation. So I think it is more more in the public discourse in recent years.
I'm curious, you know, you are the director of American Literary Translators Association. Do you interact with the other translation associations around the world? I'm guessing that they're, because of this Anglo-centric publishing, I'm guessing a lot more works of English historically have been translated into other languages. Are those programs, do they have, are they bigger? Do they have more depth?
It's an interesting question. The American Literary Translators Association has also become more international in recent years, especially during the pandemic years when we were working out, putting our programming online and making it much more accessible to people from across the world. So there's certainly been relationships at ALTA historically with the Canadian and Mexican Literary Translators Associations. And we have relationships primarily through our Emerging Translator Mentorship Program with a lot of different cultural organizations around the world that support the work of literary translation. So we now have 17 mentor and mentee pairs in our program, all working to bring new works into English from languages around the world.
As you were saying, Aron, earlier, this program was kind of hidden in many ways for a long time. Clearly, there's an evolution going on. There's growing interest. But I'm sure a lot of students have never even heard of it or thought of it. What would you say to someone to help them understand why this might be fulfilling?
Well, this is incredibly fulfilling for all the enthusiasm you hear in Kelsey's voice, for example. You know, Kelsey is, in fact, a wonderful, you know, outcome of, you know, not only our literary translation program, but our commitment to curating world literature. And I think what we tell students is language is an asset. We're especially interested in recruiting heritage speakers into our BA program because they have an asset in that language. And in fact, they have been using it as a child and as youth for their parents, for their community. But they've never seen it as an asset. So what we are trying to do is to ask, you know, heritage speakers as well as people who have studied languages in high school to consider studying translation, not necessarily to become a translator, but to become more skilled in managing intercultural exchanges in this global society. And we're hoping that the word is getting out, this program. We're very thankful that you have featured us. But again, you know, this is an evolution, as you said, and the field is evolving. We are attending to some much long overlooked areas of our practice. And I'm really very, very hopeful that we will be, you know, making the field of translation and the practice of translation, the art of translation, much more visible.
We only have about 30 seconds left. Kelsey, what would you say to a student who maybe hasn't ever considered this but might have the skills to embrace it?
That's a great question. I think that there are ways to get involved and sort of check out whether literary translation might be for you. Iowa City is just a wonderful place to start encountering work in translation, especially when the international writers are visiting. There are readings across campus and across Iowa City where you can encounter some of this work and hear a little bit about the process of how it was brought into English. And I think that could be a great start for anyone who might be curious about whether literary translation is for them.
Kelsey Veneta, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Kelsey Veneta is Program Director of the American Literary Translators Association. Aron Aji, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Aron Aji is Director of Translation Programs at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Kelsey Bigelow is an award-winning poet who lives in Des Moines and is doing her best to build community and create opportunities for Iowa poets to learn, write, publish, and perform. She's the founder and leader of the Des Moines Poetry Workshop, chair of the Iowa Poetry Association Poetry Slam, and one of the organizers of Poetry Palooza coming up on April 19th and 20th at Grandview University in Des Moines. She also works as a mental health poet, using poetry as a therapeutic tool. She is deeply invested in promoting poetry, in part because of the powerful place it holds in her own life, something that is front and center in her new poetry collection, Far From Broken, out today. She'll be at Beaverdale Books in Des Moines tonight for a book launch at 6:30, and she is with me now. Hello, Kelsey.
Hi, Charity. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And Kelsey, there's so much in this collection that is very personal. It's a very vulnerable collection. You write a great deal about your difficult childhood, about surviving an eating disorder, about self-harm as well. But I want to go back to when poetry came into your life before we talk about writing about such personal stuff. When did you first discover poetry?
Well, I first learned about poetry in what was like sixth grade when they first teach it to you in school, and I hated it. Because, you know, they teach you that it's supposed to rhyme and fit a certain meter, and I'm not Shakespeare, and those things don't come naturally to me. So I kind of wrote it off for a few years. But it was my eighth grade year. Our language arts teacher had us writing in journals for that semester, and for me, that was kind of, I used it as my free writing to kind of process a lot of what I talk about in this book, a lot of the hard stuff I was going through. And it was very cathartic, and somewhere in there, it kind of shifted into poetry. And for me, poetry just felt like a more accurate way to describe what I was feeling and thinking. And I kept it very private. I didn't share it with anybody except for my teacher, who had to read my notebook. But it became natural at some point, and it became like an extension of who I was. I couldn't not write about my life that way.
It feels like from reading your work that in some ways it was almost a life preserver for you.
Oh, yeah. Poetry saved my life many, 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 many times, and still does.
When did you start performing poetry?
I started performing poetry about it'll be 7 years this year when I first moved to Des Moines after college. I moved here. I didn't know anybody. And I, at that point, had shared poetry with my classmates in college. And I was just desperate to find other poets in the area. And I searched on Facebook for poetry in Des Moines. And I found the Des Moines Poetry Slam. I was like, I don't know what a slam is, but I'll go. And I met people, and I met the founder of the slam that night. And she is lovely, and I adore her, but she signed me up to compete without me knowing it. And I was enough of a people pleaser back then that I wasn't going to push back. So I got up on stage and did it. And afterwards, she asked me, how was that? And I said, that was absolutely terrifying, and I'm doing it for the rest of my life.
What was it about that experience that made you think this, I am going to do this forever?
I'm no stranger to the stage. I've grown up in a lot of different performance arts, but there was something about sharing my poetry into a mic, into a room full of people who were just wanting to listen to me and wanting to support me and connecting with me. And there's just something about being heard and being able to use my voice in a way I never had before that it was just, it was what I was meant to be doing.
This collection, Far From Broken, focuses on a lot of the very difficult stuff that you've experienced, and also on your journey to healing, your continuing journey to healing. What made you feel like now was the time to bring out this collection?
Well, a lot of these poems I had been performing for the last 7 years on different stages, and it got to a point both for my career strategically but also just personally that it was time for them to live together as a physical thing. This past year has been a very transformative year for me, and it just, in my own healing journey, has also been time for me to talk about my life for real and not hide everything in a poem, and just really come to terms with grieving the life that I didn't have as well as the one I did. And the way that looked was putting them together in a book and giving voice to my past self by putting poems in here that I wrote when I was younger as well as now. And yeah, it just felt like it was time for them to live together as a physical thing and show people that I practice what I preach in my work.
Would you read one of your poems for us?
Yeah. I will read my poem, one of my favorite poems in this book, because I call myself a hybrid poet, where I started as a page poet and I found spoken word later. And this is one that lives kind of equally as both. And this is called Learned Instinct. I have contorted myself enough to know how my neck and kneecap should curl to take up as little space as a disappearing act allows. It's somewhere between question mark and whiskey pour spout. And by space, I mean existence, because taking up space used to equate with being in the way. I know how to avoid mess and remove attention. And by mess, I mean existence. See, it's no crumbs on plate to hide residue from judging eyes, because those eyes only saw flaw. I have learned to quiet, like mime, with helium in my heels and mute in my voice box to remain unheard, because the heard always brought chaos, and by heard, I mean the existing. So I let closed doors and headphones become my bunker from the bellows and drywall holes, and by bellows, I mean their existence. While blankets of unwashed shaking became depression holders and secret keepers that hid my car-keyed forearms and question mark body, and by unwashed shaking, I mean the pitifulness I thought my existence was worth until I almost let it all go. Until I almost let it all go.
That's Kelsey Bigelow reading Learned Instinct from her new poetry collection, Far From Broken. And Kelsey, we talked about how you have used poetry as a way to deal with difficult things in your life. In starting to share that poetry as a performer and in publishing, was that a really frightening process for you to open up what had been a very private space?
Oh, yeah. It is incredibly terrifying to be vulnerable, but it's also incredibly freeing, and it connects you to people in a more real way. And so the process of sharing my poetry started almost a decade ago in college when I first started sharing some of my grief poetry after my mom had passed away, which in itself was terrifying. But I got to see people respond by saying things like, I didn't know there was a way to say that, or I didn't know I needed to hear that. And it has never failed in the last 10 years. Every single performance or workshop or talk that I have given, somebody, at least one person, has told me they needed to hear that or they related. And that doesn't include the people who are too shy to speak up. And so while it's incredibly terrifying to be this vulnerable and heal out loud in this way, I know that it's helping other people, and that is just, that's worth everything to me.
You use some mental health terminology in your poetry that is it's unusual to find someone, you know, specifically talking about complex post-traumatic stress disorder or dissociating in such almost medical terms. Is that a purposeful move on your part to try to help other people come to terms with their mental health struggles?
Yeah. I would say it's intentional when I'm writing the poems, it's intentional that I want to make sure I'm being understood. And those two things are the biggest diagnoses I have that lead to everything else that I have. And they're incredibly difficult to understand. They're very complex topics. And writing about them in a poem is very challenging because they're nuanced and they have a lot of dependencies. But that's why I try to include the terms so that maybe if somebody else relates, and this has happened, if somebody else hears one of my poems in here that's about dissociating and they can relate, they now have a word that they can attach to the feeling or experience that they share. And one person has told me that they have now realized, oh, maybe I have dissociation. I do that too. I'm going to talk to somebody about it and see if that's what it is. And that's so important, is that people can relate on a poetic and human level while having that medical term in there so that maybe they can try and understand themselves a little better.
As you've been on your mental health journey, has the way that you use poetry to process your emotions, has that changed?
Honestly, no. It's my entire life. What is it? I don't know how, I'm not going to do math, but since I was 13, I've been writing poetry to understand what my brain is thinking or what my heart is feeling, because as somebody who has dissociation, it's very challenging for me. And more often than not, I don't understand it until I've written it out. And that still stands true even now as a 30-year-old. I still most often have to process my life through writing, whether it comes out as a poem or just a free write brain dump kind of situation. I have to write to understand myself.
And dissociation is a mental process of disconnecting from one's thoughts, feelings, memories, or sense of identity. It's a way to protect oneself from difficult, traumatic things going on. Kelsey, you also write about self-harm, and that comes up in a lot of your poems. And I think self-harm is incredibly common. I know so many young people who either do it or have survived doing it. But it's also something that is really hidden for the most part. It can be hidden often by sleeves or, you know, a long pair of pants. Why is it important for you to write about that and what you've experienced doing it?
I think that's one that writing about it was about processing it, and honestly, I think there was something about writing it down helped me not relapse, helped me see my own growth in a poem. Sharing it with other people is helping others see, hey, you're not as alone, because most people who struggle with self-harm feel like we're alone, even though it's the most one of the most common things, especially among young people, like you said. But also to show them that it's possible to come out of it. I am now, just a couple weeks ago, was my 6th year anniversary of not harming myself, and that is the same amount of time that I was in it. And there, I getting to share this story with people is, it feels a lot like that, that it's, you're on the other side of it, and there is a life worth experiencing away from that, and it's possible.
What would you like people who are struggling with mental health challenges to know about poetry?
I would want them to know that this is a tool that you can use, that is more accessible than we often think. It can start as just your own free writing on a page, and you can find the poem within that and pull it out, or you can write a poem however works for you. But it's more accessible than you think, and I also would I emphasize this every chance I get. No one ever has to read what you write unless you share it with them. So it can 100% be for you, and no one else ever has to know that you're writing it if you don't want them to. But if you do want them to, I can guarantee you there will always be at least one person who needs to hear your story, who needs to hear your experience.
One of the other things that you write about is your chosen family, the people that you have connected with. And I mentioned earlier that you've done so much to build community around poetry in Des Moines. I mean, that's also how you've built this chosen family.
It really is. I have found some of the most beautiful people in my life through poetry. And like I said, poetry has saved my life many times. And that is a huge way. It has brought people who see me, who know me, who understand how I function, and that is just the best gift.
We only have about a minute left, but I do want to mention Poetry Palooza is coming up. Of course, this is National Poetry Month, and Poetry Palooza is coming up on April 19th and 20th at Grandview University in Des Moines, an opportunity to really get to know other poets, to perform poetry, to hear from some incredible poets. Tell me why you think people need to come to Poetry Palooza.
Oh, there's so many reasons that I can't fit into less than a minute. But it's going to be an incredible weekend. We have 6 fantastic featured poets that are going to be leading workshops and performing. We have the IPA Poetry Slam Finals happening, which is just incredible poets from across the state competing. We have workshops. We have an open mic, a book launch. It's a panel. There's something for everybody, and it's going to be incredible.
Kelsey Bigelow, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Kelsey Bigelow, her new poetry collection is Far From Broken. It is out today. She'll be at Beaverdale Books in Des Moines for her book launch tonight at 6:30. And again, Poetry Palooza is coming up April 19th and 20th. The theme this year is Poetry of Place and Echoes of Earth. It's at Grandview University in Des Moines. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News. Our producers are Caitlin Troutman, Samantha McIntosh, and Danny Gear. We get production assistance from Maddie Willis and Kate Perez. We got technical support today from Tony Sarabia. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.